Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is October 23rd, Wednesday. We have Stephen Harshberg and Peter Kendall of Elliott Wave International, and also Ira Harris. Stephen co-edits Elliott Wave International's financial forecast and writes short-term updates three times weekly. He provides commentary on the U.S. stock market, interest rates, precious metals, for the global market perspective. And over the years, he's become sought-after lecturer, been quoted extensively throughout various media outlets. He's also discussed financial markets on CNBC, Bloomberg Television. He began his career with Merrill Lynch and joined Elliott Wave International in 1994. And Peter co-edits the financial forecast. He also provides commentary on cultural trends, the economy, and the U.S. stock market for the firm's global market perspective. Peter began his career as a financial reporter and columnist in 1983. He wrote On the Money, a column for the Business Journal from 1991 to 1997, and he joined Elliott Wave International in 1992, where he's focused on popular culture and the new science of socioeconomics at the Center for Cultural Studies. He's also been contributing to Global Market Perspective since 1995, and he also contributes to Elliott Wave International's short-term update. And Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yep.
Great. I thought we'd begin Stephen and Peter with your views from the Elliott Wave perspective in terms of the macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, in terms of the financial markets, we think we're at the latter stages near the end of a very long, what we call a wave pattern that's can be traced to the early 1700s. It's various iterations have all been culminating right now in what we think is going to be the end of the greatest bull market of our lifetime that we've been living through. And so we think there's a lot of risk right now in the equity markets, and there's a lot of opportunity in some other markets that are not involved with equities at all. And we can get into what markets we like and so forth as we go forward.
So I guess, I don't know, jumping right into today and what's happening in the financial markets, and we'll pair this into our overall forecast, but gold just hit 27.77 this morning, which is a new all-time high. And it's a great window into the Elliott Wave principle, because we can look back at the last 2 years and see, well, how did it unfold from a wave principle perspective? And first of all, It's up 52% from October 2023. Silver is also up 68% from that same low. So, you know, how did this come about, and how did we experience it? And I can kind of speak to it, because it's not my forecast. I just have to write about it for the short term update. And I look back. I think I was doing it in about. Occasionally I do the update. So I was doing it in maybe it had to be late in the year last year. And so I had to kind of recount where we were and how we came through this process. So April, it's actually at the bottom was at around 18. It was 1804 in February, but you have a long period of gestation where the market is just feathering higher. And honestly, there's a lot of frustration in the process of how you identify that turn. So it's a full 6 months. It's October before you get something more definitive, and we're not like on it right away, but basically within a few days, Steve offered the forecast within the update. This is October 16th. I think the low was about the 8th. And so it's equivocal to a certain extent. A solid breakout above the top channel line will attest to gold's greater bullish potential, which will result in new highs, new all-time highs. So that's, you know, October. And then let's see, by November, the market, it did move up and hit a key level. And after that happened, gold rallied strongly in November. And as it approached a trio of old highs near 2070, the STU stated in November 29th, wave three of five will carry gold into new high territory, new all-time high territory. So the wave pattern is there. It's just not really impulsively higher. So you had to kind of live through that to get to these more definitive uptrends. And Steve was by that November, I think it was before the 29th, he was pointing to all-time new highs. And that's how that forecast played out. The gravy phase is here, but it took a while, you know, and you had to, you know, discern the wave pattern through that process.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to ask, from the Elliott wave perspective, and Ira, are you seeing similar type of behavior from a fundamental perspective?
Yeah.
So the points are well taken, because it was very hard. Yes, we know that, again, we're in that period from a fundamental viewpoint. So I'll put that picture in there, which is, you know, what were we talking about? The coming six cuts. Well, we weren't quite there yet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But the Fed looked like they were, 2024 was going to. So a lot of hard assets took comfort in that and went that way. And this is what I know. This is what they're really good at catching, at these types of turns. And for me, as a pure fundamentally with real yields, because golden real yields are very important. So when real yields are 2%, like we were positive, and yet gold keeps going higher, that is a discrepancy that I have to pay attention to. The 2% real yields keep me very flexible, but the fact that the market that a market that ought, and I stress the philosophers ought not to be rallying, keeps rallying, sit up and pay attention. And that's what they capture.
Yeah. It was the wave pattern. There's some other technical aspects to the rally that we were looking at. For example, open interest, you know, just gold open interest was lagging as the rally, as the wave pattern kept going higher and higher and higher. Open interest should have been exploding with it. And the fact that open interest was lagging let us know that we're probably in the middle of this rally. We're not near the end of it, because by the end, people are going to want to own gold hand over fist, and open interest is going to explode because people are going to be excited about it. So that lag was a technical feature of the rally that kind of gave us confidence in where we're going. Another thing that we were looking at was the total holdings in gold ETFs, which were also lagging past extremes as the rally was moving. And so we were looking at various aspects of sentiment, what was happening, and it was quite clear to us that gold had a lot higher to go based on the indicators that we use to forecast it, which is the wave principle and all these technical landscape indicators that either confirm or refute what we're seeing in terms of the wave pattern.
It's funny, because I recently read a piece by Robert Prechter, who is the president of Elliott Wave International, who writes the Elliott Wave Theorist, our sister publication. And he said there are three elements to a good forecast. I can't quite remember the third one, but I think Steve is talking about it. I think it's sentiment. But the first two are definitely the wave count, which is first and foremost. And then the second is the proficiency of the analyst. And I think we can see that this is basically Steve and Bob's forecast. And there was nuance aplenty last year. Now it's not nuanced anymore. But we have the third element, which is the sentiment. And we've been pressing the pedal to the metal, because gold just really isn't looking it's starting to get a little bit frothy, but nothing compared with the move that's taking place and the alternatives within the market. There's really, I can't think of too many that have performed as well. So,
yeah.
Interesting. In addition to those three elements that you mentioned, are you able to elaborate further from a perspective on Elliott wave theory, what it's about, what are the principles, and how does it work?
That's a great question. You have to go back to the 30s and examine the discoverer of it. His name was R.N. Elliott. And what was he trying to do? He had been through the stock market crash and was asking deep questions about, well, how does this market function? And strictly through price data, he discerned a pattern in prices, which moves from, impulsive. And it's similar to Dow theory. One of the basic premises, similar to Dow theory, and that primary trend is when we were moving in five waves, and that can happen up or down. So that was kind of the beginning of it. And then nuances have came further, but all of it was constructed by Elliott in the 30s, and both the corrective patterns and the impulsive patterns. So it's go ahead.
Well, he was looking at various price charts at the time of the Dow, of gold, of silver, of commodities, and he kept seeing these same patterns show up again and again on various charts. But he said, it can't be just because of news, because the news that affects maybe the Dow is not going to affect commodities in the same way, yet these same patterns kept coming up over and over again. So I think what he realized was there is some basic element to the natural development of human psychology that when people are in groups, when they get together, they herd. And this herding has a pattern to it. It's a three-step forward, two-step back process. And he started chronicling these patterns that show up at all degrees of trend. Nowadays, we call it a hierarchical fractal, self-similar patterns at all degrees of trend. He didn't call it that back in the day, but that's really what it is. It's just a fractal. And as psychology winds its way from deep pessimism to deep optimism, it has a pattern to it. And then when it reverses and goes from optimism back to pessimism, it has the same type of pattern. And so that's what we try to do in our job, is to figure out, we can't know the future, but we can kind of forecast the tenor of the times. And the way we do it is try to figure out where we are within the development of these patterns, because if we can figure it out, then it implies something about the future. Like we can say, okay, this is where we are in this pattern. It means this, and this about the future. And so that's kind of how we go about doing our job, using the wave principle model to try to figure out where we are within the development of human psychology in different markets.
Another aspect to it is the Fibonacci aspect, which is the Fibonacci ratio and Fibonacci numbers actually comprise. Turned out he didn't know anything about Fibonacci. He was just dealing with empirical evidence given to him by price data, but it turned out his pattern was the Fibonacci ratio and numbers are very much a part of it. Oddly, like as I said, he didn't know about that. He also obviously didn't know about fractality because it hadn't even been discovered yet. He actually was among the discoverers. If you look back in history, he's right there amongst the people that developed the whole idea of complex systems. Anyway, so that's it in a nutshell.
Very interesting. And I know Ira uses technical analysis as well. What are your thoughts, Ira, on this technical approach?
Well, look, as I said, I'm steeped in fundamentals. So when they say this goes back to as we started before, 1700s, I still read. I could pull right off of my corner here the work of Fernand Braudel and the others in the whole Braudel school, which goes back and maps out the commerce and the way things worked during the times of Philip II and the Mediterranean economy. And I love, and this is what they capture. Because it does, again, they hit on the two phrases which I paid attention to, because I paid a technician who was a great technician, a lot of money, a guy named Howard Green, who ran a company. He may still, we parted ways in 2012, but Future Tense. And he combined all of these. And for the money that I paid him, I got a Harvard education and then some, postdoc and everything, because I learned and I respect this. Fibonacci, because there's really no one. You're measuring the psychology of the market. You say a Fibonacci. He was big on cycles. I think cycles have, he taught me. So I can't do the work. I was just, it's interesting we're having this conversation because there's a guy who I play golf with who's a Princeton graduate in engineering. He's a petroleum engineer. And we started talking about markets and stuff. Well, he never looks at technicals. So I handed him, I said, okay, stop in my house. I have a book for you. Andrew Lowe, The Heretics of Finance, which is, if you're a thinker, a deep thinker, and you have a way to sometimes slough off technicals, well, this is voodoo. You know, I've heard it a million times. I said, read this before. And you have the mathematical abilities to really delve into this and say, there's a lot more to this than I ever imagined. So he's in the midst of reading. In fact, we played bocce last night. And he told me, he says, I'm getting the book back to you. I said, no hurry. I've read it a few times because I had to kick myself to assert that view. It makes you can't really do this and manage your risk effectively without this. You know, because sometimes you'll be early, but as any good technician will tell you, early is wrong unless you have, you know, other people's money to play with and you can sustain yourself for a lot longer. But the work is, and what does it do? It tracks the two greatest psychological powers, greed and fear. That's what we discovered. Because no matter markets, I don't care whether you're in Rome or whether you're here, the same two emotions really power the markets at some point. And this is what, and it's phenomenally important. So I have a great appreciation for this.
Yeah, people are people, you know, and doesn't matter where you are. People are people with the same emotions. And somehow when a groups of people get together, they herd and, you know, they look to each other to try to discern a trend and where it's going. And I think that's one of the basis for technical analysis in general. Yeah.
And for us, it's, you know, the where the waves line up, give very clear levels of where you need to do what, when, and we'll get to those for the S&P and for the NASDAQ, just, you know, but just so you know, it's like that where those levels came from is like examining the trend line that runs off of the bottom of wave twos and fours. And they're very specific levels that have meaning in an Elliott wave sense. So it's, you know, encompassing, but also practical.
Yeah.
Let's actually delve in to the publication, the financial forecast. I'm going to share my screen. So this is the October issue. And did you want to point out a few of the charts to discuss? I think you mentioned this one here prior to our start, the Wilshire 5000 divided by the annual U.S. GDP.
Yeah, that's a great valuation chart. And valuation, I mean, valuation to us is part and parcel of the wave principle. It kind of reinforces what we're looking at in terms of where we think the pattern is. And this is just the whole this chart is just fascinating to me. And Pete and I were discussing it, and it just shows the value of the market relative to the productive assets in society, which is the annual U.S. GDP. And something happened very recently that's never happened in the history of that chart. And that is the U.S. market is valued at twice the level of U.S. GDP, which has been unheard of. And if you just look back through history, you can see various different valuation levels at peak readings in the market and lows in the market. For example, we had the dot-com mania that culminated in the first quarter of 2000, and the market was valued relative to GDP at about 1.46 times. That was a peak reading at the top of the dot-com mania, after which the NASDAQ crashed 78% and the S&P was down, you know, well over 50%. And so we look at things like this. They're not great short-term timing tools, obviously, but they give you a good idea of the landscape of what's going on. Now, the long-term average of the market relative to U.S. GDP was 0.87. And so here we are, 130% above the long-term average going back to the early 70s of where the market is valued relative to the productive assets of our society. So it tells us, it's confirming to us where we think we are within the development of the wave principle, which is at or near the end of a fifth wave to the upside.
Okay, can I interrupt? Can you go back up to the first chart, I think it was, so we have the five waves, and they can, we can put it in Elliott wave context, and then we'll put that those two charts in that context as well. So keep going.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Okay, this one, 5 of 5 of 5.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, I have to scoot forward. That's from the 2000s. So you really have a primary degree fifth wave there. Now, the wave three that you'll see on the other chart, that was also a primary wave. But this one is also a other higher degrees of trend. It is the peak. You see the 5 of 5 of 5. And the very top five is a super cycle degree fifth wave. That means it started in 1932 and it is ending now. It's not the one that we spoke of before is from 1770, the late 1770s, and it's another degree higher. It's a super cycle wave. So now let's go back down to those sentiment charts that we showed. It shows small traders is the first one. And you can see this is a horse of a different color on that chart, the first one on the left that we'll get to here.
Yeah, keep going down. Yeah, there we go.
Okay. Now, Ira, you've been doing this a long time. And if you're like me, you think that small traders are particularly significant, that they are a little, you know, it happens at institutions and traders, and all the investors will be excited at the very end of the trend. But the small traders will be most excited. And sometimes in the case of total small traders net longs, those will actually sometimes stick. They get so bullish, the market turns and they're still bullish. But at this point, we think from a grand super cycle perspective, they've flashed their true selves here, and they are as bullish as they may get in our lifetimes. And the valuation chart is just another representation of that. Back at that primary degree wave peak in 2000, it was 1.46. Now it's 2. Again, and I think a horse of a different color, a wave that I think most people don't register with them that is even in place, because they've been their whole lives. It's been a generation long event. The wave three is actually part of this. So people can't really fathom it because they've just lived in a bull market world for their most of their investment lives. Even the retreats were pretty brief. And we think this one will be of a longer term because it is of such a higher degree.
I'm going to, so what you talk about here, you know, and I've, believe me, I have such great, so I have read, well, years ago when I first started in the business, you know, Contradeef, because I wanted to understand super cycles, because I think cycles are very important. So, I love this discussion, but I find this interesting that the only technical you ever hear Warren Buffett discuss is this one, right? The best capital market valuations to GDP. So I mean, my ears, and it's not that I'm a Buffett lover per se. I have great respect for Warren Buffett. He's a financial brilliant insurance operator who knows how to use money and put it to work. I have great respect for it, but you never hear him talk about that. So I'm really intrigued that you went right here. Yeah, I mean, when you get this type of divergence, which I think is what you're really pointing to, it is a time that traders certainly need to sit up. And I'm not a contrarian. I don't trade contrarian. It's to me, that's a bad habit learned, and I traded on the floor in the pits. That's a bad habit because it's based on the premise that you don't think that the public ever makes money and only the professionals do. And I think that having been a currency trader to begin with and still trade a lot of currencies, it's really my academic work. So I came to it via that. So I have all currency, everybody around me can make money for a long time in the currency markets. The ones who are carrying the losses are far, I'll never see them. It's a global phenomenon, and it could be banks in Asia. It doesn't matter. But the retail investor or the institutional investor can make a lot of money, and the losers are those who are carrying the bag, so to speak, are far other places. But this I find absolutely great. I know this is such a powerful measure of valuations, as you said. So I sat up another 5 inches because when you brought these out.
Yeah, it's like there's an old saying, you need bulls to have a bull market. The way we use sentiment though is when it gets to an extreme. So we need history. It's not good enough to know that they're bullish for the last week or last month. I want 30, 40, 50 years of history to see what they were like at turning points within the market. And then I put that in the context of what we think is going on in terms of the Elliott wave pattern. So if we have a pattern that looks like it's nearing an end, and then we have an historic extreme in sentiment, that's usually a good combination for us to be very alert that a trend reversal is somewhere out there, probably sooner versus later. So.
And again, you bring up the .com. And I think if we really look at when that, I mean, you could see the overextension, but there's, you know, from, I'm a fundamentalist, so I'll go, there's an event. What was the event for me? And I could, was when AOL got taken over, because all of a sudden we had a way to measure a valuation. We'd never had a way. Everybody was guessing, and it's no different as than the South Sea bubble, than the railroads. That it has, until you find a way to really place a value on something. And the AOL deal, Time Warner stamped a valuation because there was a way. Here you had, and now you can say, well, here's the valuation, and this is a beloved company. How far extended are we? But this is what you catch ahead of time.
Yeah, you bring up a very interesting point there, because, and Pete's talked about this a lot, is that it's a fantasy. And unless you can put a valuation on it, like an IPO before it gets valued, all it is a fantasy, and people keep, that fantasy going higher and higher and higher and higher. But all of a sudden, it hits the market, and then they have to start reporting earnings, and they have to, quarterly, they have to make their quarterly reports and sales and so forth. And you get rid of the fantasy at that point, and you have to look at reality, the reality of sales and earnings and all of those things that the market, dictates you have to do. So
yeah, there was a point in time in 2000 when not having earnings was a benefit, and it was at the very end, and it was like, even at the very, very end in March, it was like not even the AOLs and the dot-coms that had some kind of revenue. It was the ones that hadn't any that continued to push the market higher. So it was only once the reality had to be dealt with, which was March 11th, 2000, as opposed to March 10th, 2000, when the market reached its all-time high. And we're seeing something similar now. Now, it's slightly different. The fracturing of the market was in place there. It was the NASDAQ on March 10th, and the Dow had peaked on January 10th, I think. So you had a fracturing, and you have that this time, but on a much broader scale. So we've transitioned into the stock market here because we can't get away from it. It's it's time to break this down and understand why it's happening the other way. Now, the NASDAQ is trailing a peak in July, and it may go to a new high, but you see it struggling. So we have all kinds of, and other indices have not reached a high since November of 2021.
Russell 2000
is really, I mean, you can't be too sure about it at this point, but it's, if it should be continue to fall from here, it's really a thing of beauty how it kind of tries. It never gets back to the November of 2021 high, but its latest high was in July, and it tried to get there again in September or in October just now, and it seems like it might have failed. We'll know. I can give you the levels of a break below 2170 in the latest update. Steve Seitz says, as the key level. The high was actually back in 2021.
Yeah, so we're coming 4 years, you know, 3 years, three years, anniversary on a high in a market. There's, while the Dow's making new highs every day and the S&P, and it's just a tremendous divergence that's going on there that you typically don't see in third waves or the middle of moves. They typically, divergences kind of crop up toward the end of the move. And so that's something we're watching pretty closely.
Yeah, well, it's like the worker bee market that can't cope with the fantasy images. And so the July 31st high was 29.99. So as long as that, this is how it works. As long as that stays, the Russell stays below that level, we'll be confident that it's going to fall and the larger market will eventually as well.
Question on the use of Elliott Wave in particular in recent years. There's been extensive fiscal policy intervention, monetary policy intervention affecting the purchasing power of the currency. Could we get a situation where in there's a difference between nominal terms and real terms? So, you know, whether you look at it from an inflation adjusted perspective, yeah. Purchasing power, currency, gold terms, like perhaps the number, the nominal value stays relatively stable, like on equities, but the real terms, the purchasing power terms, goes lower and follows the Elliott Wave pattern.
Yeah, it's a big part of our work as to where what the denominator is, whether it's the Dow or real, we do gold and we call it real money. And by that measure, the market peaked in 1999, as a matter of fact. So this is more of the fracturing, and it's on the long, very long-term basis in that case. Or just the Dow divided by the CPI very clearly peaked in 2022, January 2022. And by that measure, we're down, and that's in real terms. So it's substantial, and it's one of the reasons why you see in the economy kind of uncertainty, housing markets starting to turn, lots of factors are already quite weak.
Yes. I think 1999, believe it or not, you know, as far back as that is to where we are today, was really an important year because the Dow at that point was valued at about 44 ounces of gold, real money, historically real money. And today it's valued at about 16 ounces of gold. So it's down over 60% from 1999. So, and in terms of the nominal Dow, I mean, we're at new all-time highs, but it's an illusion based on massive inflation. And the measuring unit of the Dow right now is just being eroded by these inflationary pressures. So if you look at it in terms of real terms, yeah, we are down quite considerably from the all-time high. And it's just because, you know, our monetary, basically through credit inflation is degrading the numerator and the denominator of what we're seeing in terms of nominal Dow. So,
another way of looking at it is just the look more globally at the stock markets in general. And one of the key ones you have to take into account is China. China peaked in 2007.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's almost hard to fathom. Yeah. And then it re-peaked or lower peak in 2015. And it's been trending lower since then. And more recently, it's been bailed out the market has been bailed out by the Chinese government, but we're on record saying that will fail, and the downtrend will resume once the short-term excitement of the measures that they've taken has worn off. There's that too. So you have weakness sweeping through many different pores.
Interesting. Any other charts that you'd like to point out in the October edition? Yeah.
Well, we want to get a little bit, I don't know. I think we should go through the S&P and the NASDAQ and, you know, what their recent highs are and what their breakdown levels are, so we can get that on the table for you guys. And then S&P, a break below 5767. The recent high of October 17th is 5878. So if it goes below 5767, we think the case for the decline being underway is very solid. In the NASDAQ, it's a break below 19622.9. Recent high was the 14th. So here, even on this short-term basis, we have things that, you know, when you go back in history and you look at a healthy rise in, say, 1959, I can remember doing the work to sort of like go back in there and see the markets would peak on the same day so consistently. It's called the harmony of the averages. And when you get disharmony instead, you have to kind of be aware that something could be taking place. It happens the opposite way on the downside. You'll see certain things peak first, and then the rally is underway. And then once they get in, same time, harmony just about in every direction.
Right. So the most important thing in our work is the pattern, is the waves. And so once we see that development of a five-wave pattern to the downside, then, you know, our antenna goes up and say, okay, we've got a structure in place that gives us a direction for the market. And that direction would be to the downside. So that's what we're doing right now, is we're watching the market very closely. We're watching the waves very closely. It looks like we're at the very latter stages of it. I'm not sure the final top tick is in, but once we see that five waves to the downside, it's when our confidence goes up. We say, okay, the next degree, the next level of the trend is pointed lower. And that's kind of where our focus will be at that point.
So I guess I would ask, well, how much time? Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to ask Iris thoughts if he sees convergence from his perspective on the same.
Yeah. See, I'm not going to let you off the hook here. And it's not an incendiary question. It's a question somebody would ask, what about when you make a call of significance and it doesn't pan out within, like, that? I mean, you have clients, you have people who subscribe, and you feel so, but it doesn't pan out in an immediate time where people are going to go, you guys are the greatest, you know. So what does that tell you, and how do you deal with that? Because I think anybody who's in this business has to, because your timing's going to be off. You're going to be wrong at times. How do you deal? What does that mean for you?
Well, we're going to lose some subscribers. We're going to miss you.
No.
Okay.
I think one of the strengths of the wave principle and using patterns is that when a pattern doesn't work out, when you violate a level that lets you know that the pattern you thought was playing out is not, it gives you an objective level to say, wait a minute, we should not have moved beyond this level based on this pattern. So when that level breaks, it gives us a very subjective level to say, well, we're wrong, or we need to look somewhere else, as opposed to sitting around and waiting, well, maybe the Fed is going to say this and this might happen. You know, there's no subjectivity to when we're wrong. It's like, you know, when a level is violated based on a pattern we're looking at, we have absolute objectivity in saying, okay, we've got to go in a different direction. And as you said, that's just part of the markets. I mean, you know, that happens all the time. You know, when you're trying to forecast or trade.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have been glib about it, but you know, we've been doing this, been around the waves for like 83, 80, 82, somewhere in there. And it seems like it's always this way. There's this market, there's this call. I remember 80, I was extremely bullish in 1980, from 82 on. But you know, it wasn't like, it didn't happen overnight. It took time for this bull market. Well, that was actually, it began in 74 by some measures, but in inflation adjusted terms, it bottoms in 82, and Bob is right on it. He got on a little early, but it showed up dramatically in August 92. I remember that, even though I wasn't in the markets at the point, but that's how dramatic it was. You couldn't miss it. And it's like, oh, maybe things will be different from here on. And he said, yeah, they will. This is a bull market that has a long, long way to go. And 83 was kind of sideways, and 84 was actually 84 was sideways. 83 was mostly up, but 84 was this weird sideways thing that seemed like it took forever. And you know, we lived through that, and the wave principle survived, and it's been making forecasts all the way. It's not, you know, we sometimes miss it, but the waves are all there as we look back on them, and they will be this time. We're sure of it as well. So we just, you know, try to get through it.
I love that answer, because, you know, we all have to deal with it. I've managed money. I still advise people who are in the hedge fund world, and everybody deals with it. Everybody's had drawdowns where people can't, you know, that's why they have, especially the hedge funds. Yeah, I would never go into a hedge fund in which I can't get my money out in a very short time, because that means you're in investments that don't have enough liquidity. So, you know, I always pride myself when I ran a hedge fund that you could get out tomorrow, because everything I'm going to trade is liquid enough for you to get out tomorrow. So I appreciate that immensely, because this is what differentiates from academic economists. Academic economists are predicated that they have unlimited time. Yeah. That's how they work. Those models will prove out at some point, maybe. And then as I get older, I understand what Keynes meant when he said, you know, in the long run, we're all dead. And I read it out of his, he wrote it in 1923.
Yeah.
But that's because he was poking at the academic economists. Even back then, everything was predicated upon in time. I don't have that time as an investor.
Yeah.
Right. So I really appreciate your answer.
Yeah. Well, I would say you made me think of, like, well, people that have bought and hold, that's sort of how their mindset is. It's going to happen eventually. But our point would be, well, no, you're just kind of denying the fact that there's a downside. And we, on the other hand, but we can use that mentality and say, well, you got to buy and hold sometimes, and then you have to sell and hold when the time comes. So it's kind of like buy and hold, but sell and hold when that time is there. So, or neutral, but those are all part of it. But I guess it's the same. You have to be persistent. We think it's an error to think, to deny that the market goes down sometimes.
It's a great, because, you know, I think people need to hear that, because they expect, you know, from people who put their quote unquote asses out on the line. I mean, this is their business. This is what you've chose, but it's not, again, you know, I look at it, it's probability based anyway, probability of market outcomes, but it's probability of the work outcomes too, because you're not going to, there are extenuating circumstances, but the ability is to say, hey, I'm wrong here, and stand up and admit it, and we'll live to fight another day. And I think that's the critical importance.
Okay. I wanted to check on how much time we have.
Oh.
We can do another five minutes or so.
Okay. Okay. So let's get to the back of the ladder, because something that the last two charts, or maybe there's a picture and two charts, and this is important to me, because that's how I ended up here. Was the one thing that Steve mentioned was what Elliot found that he was dealing with was the human psychology. Social mood is not just contained in the markets, although it does direct the market. It's the main, what we call sociometer. Now, what is socionomics? Well, that's what I would call our extension of the analysis to extra market activities. At first, it was just observations about culture in the 80s, and then gradually Bob developed it into, well, there's two major textbooks and a lot of different applications over the years. And you know, so that's my doorway into this was that. And well, I would say initially they were more observations, but at this point the trend is so extended that I feel like they actually give us a good insight into the market. So these extra market activities that are taking place are playing out in a way that we can, you know, say something about where social mood is and where it's going. So the two items that we happened to cover this week were what I would call monumental construction, the construction of the world's tallest buildings, which we've shown a long history for them to correlate with market peaks. There's the picture. That's the
picture right there.
That's the Senna Tower, a 500 meter super tall that will be the tallest residential structure in the world. So there's different ways of measuring it. There's, as we opened the piece by noting that the world's tallest is also under construction in Saudi Arabia. The world's the tallest building in the United States. Now, these regional things are important because they tend also to appear at highs for their country that they are within. So for instance, the Petronas Towers were built in the mid-1990s as Malaysia, the place where they are resided now, they were reaching a peak through that process. So the signal happens when the plan is made, and it is usually built through the peak. And that's exactly what happened with Petronas Tower, as well as through 2000, 2007, Abu Dhabi was that one. And then there's a lot of subtleties to it that are covered in this issue. Just to give you an example, the distance from the financial center, which is still New York, but here you have a building that's being constructed in Brazil. And this is actually from ancient history. We know that when the Greeks were finally peaking out, their architects went abroad and built, for instance, the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, which is one of the seven wonders of the world. Anyway, so you have, that's one of them. And then another one that we covered in the issue, you'll see the charts. These are percentage share of total wealth held by the richest 1% of U.S. households. In 99, you see this commotion about it, which is, you know, it's, you know, it's around, it was rising all the way from the 80s. But then at the peak, people started to be concerned about, they call it the grotesque gap at that time. And so go forward to the next chart, this, which updates that, and it shows you the development since then. That goes back to the 1990s, and you see the peak in 2000, a decline with the decline in the stock market. And then since then, in the mid-2000s or so, it's been rising steadily. It probably peaked in 2021 with the overall market. I forget the exact peak, but it's basically does, which is peak with stock prices. So our point is that redistribution of wealth is what a bear market does. And we believe we're about to begin that process. So that, I would call it stratification of social mood or the social realm. And it's just what happens in a bull market. The rich get richer, but the poor get richer as well. So people don't really notice until the very end for some reason.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
That's really so brilliant. Yeah. And so it's a redistribution of a bear market is a redistribution of income downward, whereas the bull is a redistribution upward.
You'll get thinner and thinner. Well, share of the wealth is held by fewer and fewer as the bull market rises. They own the stocks. That's one reason. But it's also, I mean, it's a deep cultural stratification. It actually goes back into civilizations in the past. But civilization itself is generally begins with a stratification. So you can go way back in time with this one. So that's kind of cool too.
Yeah, I love that comment. You know, as a recession was, as I learned long ago in my economic studies, was, you know, a redistribution of wealth to, as the cynics would say, the rightful owner, right? Over and over again, right?
Yeah, right. The 30s is the classic situation. This redistribution, you know, all the stories about so and so got wiped out by the crash, you know, but that wasn't everybody. It was just, you know.
Well, it was the morality of what's his name, who was who was the under Hoover, who was the secretary? Oh, Mellon, who said, right, liquidate, liquidate, liquidate. And what, and that the rightful, basically the rightful owners would recapture their wealth, which had been lent out to the debtors who are now going to, it's so Calvinistic in its viewpoint. And I, you know, and here we live in a world where Bernanke feared that more than anything. I think if you ask me the Bernanke doctrine, it's the fear, and that was his academic work, was what happened in the 30s and up to 37 and the mistakes that were made. There was going to be quantitative easing, to me, was all about preventing a liquidation of assets. You know, going into the Irving Fisher, I'm not meaning to get pedantic here, but these are the huge mind thinkers who worked through this and actually lived through it. Keynes himself, you know, and I'm reading more Keynes right now. I'm actually reading the psychology of Keynes. So Minsky wrote a book on Keynes in 1975, 76, which I never had read. And I read copious amount. I just read it. I read it on an airplane coming back from Florida. So it was really worth a read because Keynes gets a bad rap.
We'll have to take a look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's it was written by Minsky. I have that here. I can flash it. It's sitting on my desk, but very, very interesting. The whole viewpoint of it. You should take a look at it. Minsky on Keynes. I was, because I have a lot of respect for Minsky, is basically the academic voice, I think, of Elliott Wave.
Okay. I don't know enough about Minsky to.
Well, I see. I know a little bit, but not prepared to discuss Hyman Minsky, the Minsky moment, which I think applies. I think we're going to get there in terms of the debt situation.
Yeah.
Well, the greatest thing is about 2-3 years ago, the head of the People's Bank of China.
So I don't know. We could probably end with.
Yeah. No. But the Chinese were lecturing the West about caution about Minsky, why the Chinese were doing some of the things that they were doing because they were afraid of a quote unquote Minsky moment. So the world gets stood on its head, which I kind of like.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a good point to end on. China is definitely heading towards a Minsky moment. Exactly right. they can delay it a little bit with some of these shenanigans and monetary movement, but basically they have a debt problem that they can't get out of, and they could issue more debt, but that doesn't get them out of it. And that's been the situation for years.
Right.
Yeah.
More debt is the only way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's been a fascinating, insightful discussion. How can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work, Peter and Stephen, and how can they subscribe to the publications?
Well, if you go to our website, which is www.elliottwave.com, there's that's one word, Elliott Wave, and there's two L's and two T's in Elliott Wave. And we actually have a special of, if you put in www.elliottwave.com/FRA.
Oh.
Your listeners, and we offer a lot of great material, courses on the Wave Principle. You can sign up and check out our newsletters and some of the other publications that we have, and just learn a lot about Elliott Wave and kind of the things that we look at, which is a little bit different than, say, your average maybe technician or your average academic study. We think it's got some pretty insightful things that you might like, and click around and give us a look.
Great.
Absolutely. And Ira, from your perspective.
I did write that blog, Notes from Underground, for 14 years, three or four times a week, you know, covering, you know, it was basically more for traders and investors who were smart enough to look and dig deeper and develop a longer time frame. But now I'm just here. I'm just at FRA, and I love to do these. I mean, this is such a great thing for me to be able to sit here and do this, you know, especially it's really, to me, the culmination of a career, because I've been studying and reading this and trading. I'm still trading. I mean, I'm looking away here because I got my screen going and I just got it executed on a few trades. You guys would probably disagree with them, but that's okay. if we can come back and do another, because, you know, I want to pick their brains about what they did in analyzing Japan as a, to me, Japan is a great paradigm for where we're at. And I'm not the only one who thinks that, but out of that paradigm comes a lot of opportunities that are going to confront us shortly, I think. So I'm in their camp.
Yeah.
And they did raise an issue that I, because that gold, that S&P gold or Dow gold chart, which goes back, and I know somebody just cited it, and I don't, I think it was Luke Roman, but if you go back to where the S&P gold is and that price that they say on the valuation, we're back to August of 1971, which is a phenomenal date because that's when Bretton Woods ended, or Nixon took us off the gold exchange standard.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
right. Right?
Yeah.
So, I'm pretty sure that that's right, that it's within a very close, which, wow, what a journey this has been for 53 years.
Yeah, right, yeah, right. Yeah. It's all been monetary inflation.
Yeah, which you guys brought up. So, I mean, that's the only I was going to speak to, you know, because you guys brought that up, and I think that's such a great point. So I wasn't sure where we were going to go, but this has really been great for me.
Yeah, great.
Well, we enjoyed it too.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
Peter,
thank you.
Thank you.
Really, this has been great.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.